Next case on the calendar is 98-1241, disciplinary counsel versus David M. Linick, Ellen Brown.
Thank you. Good morning. May I speak to the court? My name is Lori Brown, counsel for the later disciplinary counsel. Part of the facts in this case are stipulated to. In fact, nearly all of the facts are stipulated to in this case. It was also stipulated that the respondent, David Linick, violated DR2107A1 and DR5107A2. The panel in this case recommended that the respondent be suspended for 1 year with the entire suspension stayed. The board recommended that respondent be suspended for 1 year with 6 months of the suspension stayed. Relator does not object to the board's recommendation of that particular sanction, 6 month actual suspension. Relator does object to two parts of the board's opinion, and those are the parts finding that respondent's conduct did not violate 1102A4 and 1102A6. In this case, respondent's conduct violates 1102A4. The clear and convincing proof of that violation is as follows. Respondent made active choices to deceive Glidden. Respondent accepted money from Mr. Zuckerman and Mr. Cantor, and he did not tell Glidden. He had numerous opportunities to tell Glidden. He chose each and every time not to tell Glidden. Respondent was being paid a salary for his work, and Glidden believed that that was all the money he was getting for the work that he was performing for Glidden.
Ms. Brown, if we found that you're correct, that the other two rules have been violated, would that increase the penalty in your mind?
It does not in this case, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm going to address that in the mitigation section, and respondent has excellent mitigation in this case. He has admitted the conduct. In fact, he's admitted all the facts that I'm giving you. And for that reason, we believe that the sanction recommended by the board is appropriate. However, we do believe that this court should find expressly that there was a violation of 1102A4 and 1102A6, as well as the two stipulated violations.
But not increasing the penalty because there were further violations.
Correct. That's correct.
I think what you're looking to us for is to establish that when someone does what Mr. Linick did here, it's deceitful conduct. You can't say, well, this isn't deceit or fraud or whatever the legal provides. It is deceitful. And I think you want us to say that so that in the future that opinion can be used to advise lawyers that they can't do this, and if they do, it's going to be considered to be deceitful conduct.
That's exactly correct.
If you got the fitness issue, or the fitness practice issue, which is a little more difficult, I guess. But.
Yes. Also, with regard to 1102A4, respondent argues that he did not lie to Glidden. That's true, he didn't lie to Glidden. Nevertheless, he violated 1102A4 because he engaged in deceitful conduct. Not telling them was deceitful. That also violates 1102A4. Addressing 1102A6, it's absolutely correct that we have not argued, Relator has never argued in this case, that respondent is not fit to practice law. So this is a different animal, 1102A6. What we are arguing is that the conduct engaged in by respondent, in other words, deceiving his employer about these payments from Zuckerman and from Canner, adversely reflects on his fitness to practice law. And I think the basis of this is if you look at Gov Bar Rule 1, which sets forth the 16 factors that are used to determine whether a particular individual is fit to be admitted to practice in the state of Ohio. One of those factors says that a person is not fit if they have engaged in conduct involving fraud, deceit, misrepresentation. Fraud, dishonesty, deceit, misrepresentation. He, in this case, engaged in that conduct. That's one of the factors. And that conduct adversely reflects on his fitness. Doesn't make him unfit. It just adversely reflects and consequently violates 1102A6. Another area that Relator has addressed is in response to respondent's closing arguments to the panel. And this is an area that is repeatedly raised in disciplinary cases, and this is a prime case, a prime example of a situation that this court could expressly address this issue. Respondent argued that he could not be found to have violated 1102A6, and sorry, A4, because he did not intend to deceive. He did not willfully violate that statute, that section of the code. GovBar Rule 4 provides that a willful breach of the code shall be punished as provided in GovBar Rule 5. That section, that GovBar Rule, does not mean that one needs to have specific knowledge that their conduct violates a specific rule. In order to accept that argument, I'd like to compare it to a criminal defendant being tried for murder under 2903.02. The person being tried for murder intends to kill, intends to harm his victim, and in the process violates Revised Code Section 2903.02. Believe me, he doesn't know he's violating Revised Code Section 2903.02 when he murders someone. But nevertheless, he is prosecuted and sentenced for violating that particular code. In this case, respondent engaged in conduct that he didn't know at the time violated 1102A4. However, he intended to engage in that conduct, and thereby he violated that section of the Code of Professional Responsibility.
I thought he said he knew, that's different, I guess. He did say that he knew he should have, that he was wrong by not telling Glidden that he was getting money for referring cases to his friend.
Yes.
But he didn't know that was a violation of the rule.
Yes, and that particular argument is made in different ways in this case. I think that all the rule requires, any section of the Code of Professional Responsibility requires, is that the attorney willfully engage in the conduct that violates the code. The attorney doesn't necessarily need to know, although I will grant you that sometimes they do know what they're doing violates the code, but they don't necessarily need to know that a particular act violates a particular section of the code.
We've never held that that's a standard, that one has to know that they're violating the code, I don't think, have we?
No.
That would seem to be sort of self-defeating of what the grievance procedures process is supposed to be doing, I think.
Yes. Nevertheless, and I'm not particularly pointing a finger in this case, however it was argued in this case, that the respondent cannot be found to have violated the rule unless he willfully violates that particular rule. And I think that's a stretch of the intention of the code and the intention of the disciplinary process. I think that if you look at the two cases that were cited in Relator's brief, they're both judicial discipline cases, but in particular the Gustafson case says that a judge may be sanctioned for a willful violation of one of the canons if he intended to engage in the conduct for which he is sanctioned, whether or not he knows it violates the rule. And I think that's specifically applicable to this case. The respondent in this case intended to engage in the conduct. He knew exactly what he was doing. No one deceived him as to the nature of the money he was taking. No one deceived him as to where the money came from, where it was going, how it got there. This isn't like someone who makes a mistake in the accounting of his IOLTA account. There were no mistakes in this case. He willfully accepted the funds, and he willfully used them for his own purposes. And I believe that is enough to prove that he in fact violated 1102A4. And the fourth objection had to do with the mitigation, and I addressed that in response to Justice Douglas' question. And if there's any further questions, I'd reserve a few minutes.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Mr. Kettlewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Please support Charles Kettlewell on behalf of Mr. Lenning in this case. We are here on a narrow issue, and it's an issue that had a parallel issue in the Burkhardt case a few years ago, an instance where a woman had pled guilty or been found guilty, of a felony violation, and an issue in the discipline case was whether the fact of those convictions alone evidenced a violation of DR 1102A3, which was illegal conduct involving moral turpitude, and this court held that it was not. It held that the actual elements needed to be proven on a specific violation have to be proven. Now, there's two issues here. One is an intent to engaged in misconduct, the other is the willfulness standard under Gatavar Rule 4. And I have to understand, we don't have many disagreements on this case. In fact, in 1996, we had reached stipulations on this case to go forward with the admissions. And it's been delayed for other reasons. Excuse me. The willfulness violation, I think, is the one where we say a lawyer is charged with the knowledge of what these rules are, and it takes a willful violation. But if we're going to charge or fine a person who is engaged in deceitful conduct or misrepresentation or fraud, then those elements of those conducts must be proven. In this case, there is evidence that could support that finding, and there's evidence that could dispute that finding, and the panel heard the evidence. Ms. Brown, in her brief, stated correctly, no unforced this respondent, Mr. Lenning, to refer a legal work to Mr. Zuckerman and Mr. Tanner. No one has questioned that that referral was done okay, the bills were all approved in an appropriate manner, and the biggest bill was approved by a separate committee. There's never been any dispute about that. But the next one was, no one forced him to accept the money that was offered back to him by Mr. Zuckerman and Mr. Tanner. That is true as well. The panel that heard this case was well aware of that fact. And the last statement, I agree again, no one forced the respondent to not disclose the receipt of these funds because immediately or at some point in time prior to when he actually did, in fact, disclose them.
Was he, does the record indicate that he no longer works them, with the exception, I guess, of some residual or time of the hearing work he's doing? Was he fired or terminated because of this conduct?
Yes, and what happened, and it's important this be understood, when questions were being asked of him by the general counsel of Glidden, it was a question about referring cases to people that he knew. It had nothing to do with, nor was there a suspicion, that he was having any money paid to him by those lawyers. He voluntarily disclosed. He knew he was wrong. That's what Mr. Bowers just said. He came to testify on behalf of Glidden. He was wrong. He knew he was wrong. And he worked with Mr. Lenning for years. At that point in time, Mr. Lenning disclosed it. He also was confronted with certain decisions at that point in time. He lost his job, stepped down after 19 years working for this corporation. And a real important factor that I hope this court takes into consideration in determining the ultimate sanction is that if a practicing lawyer with a private practice is charged with a grievance matter in November of 1995 is when he lost his job. And it takes 3 years to get the matter completed. They still have clients, they still have a practice, they still have a livelihood, and they still function as a lawyer, albeit that the potential discipline hangs over their heads. But in this instance, this gentleman had no private practice. When he left his 19 years of corporate practice, he was out on the streets. And he has been, the evidence showed, he was able to support himself to a very minor extent with this over his head. And he ultimately, basically, completely lost that ability because the lawyers who had extra space to let him share at no cost, or a very minor cost, had to move. And they said to him, David, you either have to pay a share of the new lease or we're not taking the extra space. And he didn't know, and doesn't know yet today, whether he's going to be suspended or not suspended.
Well, let's get to the issue that the relator raises, and what seems to me to be an important issue, whether we are going to say, whether we're going to disagree with the panel and the board and say that if a lawyer is an employee of a company, an employer has the authority to refer cases to private counsel, and that lawyer takes money from the private counsel because he's referred cases to them, whether we're going to say that's deceitful conduct under the code or not. I have a problem with your argument saying that's not deceitful. It seems to me deceitful. So persuade me if you can, that's not deceitful conduct.
Let me tell you that, and as I said, there's issues can be viewed both ways. And the panel viewed the totality of the circumstances, which is what was done in all different cases. They looked at it. They looked at how this started. They looked at the fact that there was no scheme, no agreement, no condition of referral fees coming back. That had money not come back, cases would have continued to be referred. They looked at how it got started with Mr. Zuckerman, I believe it was, where there had been a malpractice area issue, and $5,000 was paid jointly by Mr. Zuckerman and Mr. Lenning. And then Mr. Zuckerman, after getting a fee, gave half from a referral from Glidden Company through Mr. Lenning, gave part of it back.
It seems that what you just said, it seems that in its origin, there was something wrong with it, the fact that they, maybe not, but there was a referral to Zuckerman because Yeah, that's the way we'll pay off our malpractice judgment.
And yet, Lyndon was not concerned about the referral going to Mr. Zuckerman. Mr. Zuckerman did the work, the fee that was paid was proper, and had he just said to Mr. Lenning, at some point in time, Mr. Lenning here, you know, I'm the one that brought that malpractice, here's your $2,500 back, and this had never gone any further, we wouldn't be here today. Mr. Lenning wouldn't have lost his job. I simply don't think we would have been here today. But something started then, and it didn't stop, and that was Mr. Lenning's responsibility, and he has assumed responsibility for that, and he's paid a significant price. But this is the evidence, Mr. Chief Justice, that I think the panel is looking at, and you may well find, opposite the panel and the board, you may find that in these circumstances it was either an omission that therefore was a misrepresentation. If we look at the argument that because of the 2107 and a 5107 violation, which were admitted 2 years ago, if you go to the King versus Hauser case, it was a civil remedy in that type of situation. They didn't look at whether that was a deceit upon the client for not having told the client that a fee was going to be shared, and they didn't find it was a deceit. Now, that was a civil case. That wasn't this case. But it was one of the issues, and is one of the issues, that the panel and the board were taking into consideration and deciding in the totality of what went on in this case, is this something for which Mr. Lenning should be found a violation of 1104? And Your Honor, you made a point, I think, in focusing on this. What we're here today for, much like Burkhardt, was to say, does this type of fact pattern violate a particular DR? But also, we are here, as you stated, this opinion can be used to advise lawyers in the future that they can't do this. Believe me, if an opinion comes out today that says the facts of this case and what happened to this lawyer, what he has gone through, he brought it on, I'm not saying that, but he's been out of work for 3 years, he's lost the income, he's lost a great deal, then that's going to send a pretty clear signal.
No, but that's all.
And he's suspended for 1 year with all of
his pay. But that's all mitigation. That isn't us setting a standard for what kind of conduct we expect from lawyers. And if we say this is not deceitful conduct, where you violate the rules express them, and there's express provisions, you know, you violate the rule, you benefit from using your position with your employer to refer cases, good lawyers, okay, that's fine, but the rule says you can't do that.
Can't get the money back.
Right.
Don't get the money back without telling us in the
right. Right. If we say that is not deceitful conduct, then this opinion will be used in other cases to say, well, the court said that lawyer could do this and the employer didn't know about it. That's not deceitful conduct, so then this new conduct before us is not deceitful. This is an important case to be used for setting a little bit of the standard on what is deceitful conduct when we are continuing to see deceitful conduct in lawyers.
Your Honor, please understand that Mr. Lenning and I both can understand that this court concludes that this was a violation of DR 110284. He understands that, I understand that. The argument was presented to the panel saw all the evidence, and they concluded it was not. Mr. Lenning will not, he does not take exception. He did not file objections in this case. He wants to get on with his life. He wants this over so he can practice law again.
Well, he's not.
And so it's really in your hands. It's a legal issue now, and it is truly in your hands to decide whether the totality of these circumstances is a violation of 110284.
If we do not change the sanction, why does it matter to him that we've said this is deceitful conduct? He doesn't mean this for what we normally think, or for some other reason?
No person wants to be in double discipline once. No person wants to have a record that says, I did this and it's a violation of the rules he's admitted. And of course, he doesn't want the additional violation in his name that it was a dishonest or deceitful or misrepresentation act. But he understands, he clearly understands this court may reach that decision. And the court will reach whatever decision it does under the totality of the circumstances, as it has to. And that's not a problem. The difference on the sanction, he wasn't opposing the sanction. We did not file objections. Once these objections were filed, I felt, as counsel, it was my best advice that we should point out that if you look at the totality of all the mitigating circumstances in this case, the message can very clearly be sent to lawyers, don't ever do this. And even if the sanction is a one-year term certain, which all of us say, he's lost 3 years of practice. You read my brief, I won't repeat my mitigation part, it's not disputed. But that's the only part of the sanction. But there's no, he knows he did something wrong. He's admitted it in November 1995, nearly 3 years ago. And we're waiting to find out what the ultimate sanction is going to be. On the 1102A6, fitness to practice law, that one, I think the evidence of how disciplinary rules are enforced would say that this conduct does not violate that section. I believe when you look at the purpose of that rule, it will say that it is to find some sort of specific type of conduct that does reflect that person on fitness to practice. If this court is going to say any violation of any disciplinary rule is automatically an A6 violation, then we'll never argue that issue again. But that's not what the court has said in the past. We've had serious conduct, very serious conduct, that does not reflect that person on fitness to practice law. And there is no evidence in this proceeding that Mr. Lennox was in any way lacking in any competency. It's not even argued that he was not fit. It is a legal issue, basically, of whether under this circumstance he has to have that additional. And that doesn't affect the sanctions either as far as the recommendations.
Would you agree, Mr. Cutterwell, that there could be a situation in which a lawyer is recognized as an outstanding technician, very, very excellent lawyer, whatever the skill is, he or she is very good at it, but the lawyer is found to have been lying to clients, lying to a court over some period of time. Would that make it an egregious situation of not the skill to practice the law, but in fulfilling the other responsibilities? Would you say that we would never find an independent basis for unfitness, independent of the skill, based upon their...
On the fact pattern, as I understand it, he's continually lying in misrepresentations to the court over a long period of time. I would not be objecting to an A6 violation under those types of circumstances. I think that's different. But I'm not saying that because you have violated another disciplinary rule, you can't also be under an A6. I'm just saying the fact that you did violate another disciplinary rule doesn't follow that you're under an A6. Lying to the court is very serious stuff.
But it does.
I think you made the point that you don't see A6 as relating only to the skills of practicing law versus honesty and all that sort of thing.
No, it's today. Is this a person you can turn to today, say to the public, as far as his fitness to practice law today, it's much like a rehabilitation proceeding, if you had that type of proceeding, this person is fit today to practice law. If there's nothing wrong with him today and his fitness to practice law, then the A6 need not be there. And I would say it should not be there.
That's actually missing the point of the argument that the disciplinary counsel made, which is it's the words are conduct. So we're only talking about his conduct, which adversely reflects on his fitness. And the way we judge fitness, of course, is the GovBar rule that deals with the various factors that go into evaluating the fitness of a person to be a lawyer. So I mean, it was made very clear that it's not talking about your client's particular fitness to practice today. It is whether or not his conduct adversely reflected on his fitness using those criteria.
Well, the annotations, when the 69 code was adopted and then utilized over the years, there were different directions people went on this one. Some said it was just such a broad rule, it had no meaning. But what the courts seemed to be starting to say, even by 1979, that's why I referenced to the annotated code in 1979, and the annotations to the model code of professional responsibility, just saying we need something specific. This is not a catch-all. But I agree,
right.
It's the conduct.
But it might be all 102. Your point is all any time you were found to violate the 102A deceit, you would then, by definition, have a 106 violation.
I don't think you would necessarily, just because you have an A.
No, your argument is that shouldn't flow.
No, I think you have to look at each of them, and you look at the totality of all the circumstances. But Mr. Lennox has authorized me to, instructed me to, and I say to you, and he simply wants to get on with his life, and hopes for a quick decision in this case. And if you find that it's a violation of A4, that's so be it. The panel looked at it, the board looked at it, and now you are looking at it, and that's what our system depends upon. And so we await your decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cutwell. Ms. Brown, you saved 6 minutes of your time.
Thank you. Counsel referred to the Gladys Burkhart case. I don't believe that stands for the proposition that we've not proved the elements of 11284 in this case. I believe that what the Gladys Burkhart case stands for is in the area of moral turpitude, which is 11283, that it's not, we just can't pick a crime and say it's per se moral turpitude. I think that each element of the crime, as opposed to each element of the conduct, they need to be managed and balanced together to determine whether it's moral turpitude or not. I think that apples and oranges in comparison to this particular case.
Ms. Brown, how would you distinguish the A4s from A6s in terms of the...
Is it automatic?
Right.
When I was sitting there listening to the discussion, I was trying to think in my mind of a particular time when a person could violate A4 and not violate A6. The reason A6 is alleged in this case is that the conduct occurred over a period of 3 years. Over 15 times, Mr. Lennox took money from Mr. Tanner and Mr. Zuckerman and made conscious decisions every time he got the money not to tell his employer. That conduct as a whole adversely reflects on his fitness to practice law. Nothing else does. I will grant you that. He has been honest, he has repaid, he's been fired, etc. But that conduct as a whole. Now, whether one particular instance of filing a pleading that's a little bit on the edge, does that adversely reflect? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I had to look at, as Mr. Cutwell suggested, the totality of the circumstances.
That might be a legitimate distinction, that it's a pattern, so therefore that conduct reflects more on your fitness.
Yes, exactly correct.
Ms. Brown, I take it from reading the briefs that there's no issue regarding the appropriateness of the fees that were charged to the, in other words, the outside counsel didn't charge extra higher fees because they were paying Mr. Lennox?
Frankly, that issue has been discussed. It was not raised in Mr. Lennox's case. It was raised in Mr. Zuckerman's case, and that's a matter of record with this court. As any naturally curious individual, and obviously a member of this court, have to look at Mr. Zuckerman's fees, Mr. Tanner's fees, and wonder how they could give up part of their fees. I mean, I frankly wonder. Nevertheless, I don't know how they could. We have accepted that the fees were not excessive, that they were appropriate, and Mr. Tanner and Mr. Zuckerman simply made their own personal decisions to give Mr. Lennox part of those fees. Just one other brief point. Mr. Kettlewell has insisted that his client was not engaged in a scheme in this case, and I would suggest that, in fact, it was a scheme. If you look at it as the totality of the circumstances again, he referred cases to his old friends, Mr. Zuckerman and Mr. Tanner. He then approved their bills, Glidden then paid their bills, and he received money directly back from those bills that were paid by his employer. And that is a scheme. One more specific point regarding his duty to disclose to his employer, 2107 and 5107 imposed a duty on him, an express duty, to tell Glidden about the fees he was receiving from Tanner and Zuckerman, and he failed in that duty. And that is deceitful conduct. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. We'll be advised of our opinion. We're taking a very brief recess.
All rise.